This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Do you remember the Arab Spring? 2.5 years ago, a young Tunisian man immolated himself to protest the dictatorial rule and the impoverished conditions of his life. His suicide became a catalyst for mass rebellion across the Middle East. And beyond that region, tremors destabilized the ruling circles of the U.S. and Europe as well. The energy and euphoria generated by the vision and possibility of a better world was definitely contagious. But looking at the same terrain today, the savageries of war seem once more to be smothering the hopes of a better world. Syria is perhaps the fulcrum on which this struggle presently is poised. To explore the dynamics swirling in and around Syria, we've contacted Con Hallinan. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus and a contributor to many progressive publications on international politics. Good morning, Con, and it's a pleasure to have you back again on Red Eye.
Good morning, Mordecai.
Syria, too, had its brief experience of an Arab Spring. Can you sketch the counterattack by established powers to block its success?
Well, the thing about the Arab Spring in Syria is that there's a kind of a wider context for it, and it's a reflection of how dictatorships respond to threat. People forget that back in 2005, the Bush administration sort of gave a speech targeting specifically the overthrow of the Assad regime in Syria, and a government change and a overthrow of the government in Iran, and also a marginalization of Hezbollah. Now, when the speech was made, there wasn't really much that the Bush administration could do about it. It was sort of more blowing smoke. But, you know, the problem is that when you have governments like in Syria or in Iran, paranoia runs rampant. And so they began to look at anything that was going on as some sort of effort by outside forces to overthrow their government, and that partly reflects the Iranian response to the Green Revolution 2 years ago. So what happened in Syria was a series of demonstrations in Homs that were aimed at the dictatorship and were aimed essentially asking for democracy. And they were nonviolent. And the Syrian regime responded violently, very violently. And a lot of these demonstrators were kids. They were teenagers and young teenagers at that. And security forces killed some of them. They arrested them. They tortured them. This is awful kinds of things. And that was the spark that set off the kind of explosion that's going on in Syria. Unfortunately, what happened was that it very quickly morphed into a proxy war. And what we have going on now is really a proxy war, with on one side Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Maliki government in Iraq, and Iran, and Russia. And on the other side, you have the United States, the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is the group of monarchies that control most of the Arab Gulf, but also includes Morocco and Jordan, and the French and the British, and at least parts of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So you've gone from what you, I think, correctly characterized as a sort of a glimmer of the Arab Spring in Syria into a civil war, which has become a proxy war, and a horrendous one at that.
And what glues together these two camps, so to speak?
Well, the camps are, it's kind of interesting. The thing is, there isn't one thing that glues them together. I mean, that's part of what makes this so complex, is that you have a lot of actors, and they don't necessarily have the same agendas at all. I mean, let's take on the Syrian side. Of course, the Assad regime is attempting to maintain itself in power, and that's why they're fighting this civil war. In the case of Hezbollah, and in the case of the Maliki government in Iraq, this is more about the Sunnis versus Shiites, and Shiites make up about 15% of the Islamic world. They are only a majority in a very few countries: Iran, Bahrain, Iraq, Azerbaijan. But they make up a plurality in Lebanon, and they are the ruling group of people, about 10% of the population in Syria. And this Sunni versus Shiites, which is something that goes all the way back to the 7th century in Islam, it hasn't been that big a thing, but it has been blown into a big thing. And in part, what happened was that back in 2007, the King Abdullah of Jordan gave a speech in which he talked about the danger of a Shiite crescent, and that is Hezbollah, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and that it would be a threat to peace in the Middle East. And the United States jumped on that. I think they encouraged him to make that speech, but they jumped on that and began to organize a kind of alliance on the basis of Sunnis versus Shiites. Not that the United States really cares about the differences Sunnis and Shiites, and the differences are extremely small. I mean, less than those between Catholics and Protestants, for instance. But it has always been a handy way to divide populations. And so essentially what you've got now is that you've sort of opened up this Pandora's box of sectarianism in the Middle East. And that is going to go in ways that I'm not sure that any of us can really predict, but not good ways, I'll tell you.
There are two countries in your listing of the discussion so far that you haven't touched on, but seem to me, anyway, to be very important actors. One, of course, is Israel, and the other is Turkey.
You see, Turkey has an interesting... a couple of years ago, Turkey sort of redefined itself. As they wanted to be the big dog on the block, essentially. Now remember, Turkey is not an Arab country. They don't speak Arabic, they speak Turkish. And there's always a little bit of strain between Turkey and the Arab countries because the Ottoman Empire held them all under its sway at some point. And, you know, nobody likes to go back to issues of empire. But the Turks essentially decided that they were going to get along with all their neighbors and that they were going to develop a kind of a high-level international profile. And to that end, they intervened in the Georgia-Russia war in a way that was very positive. They tried to do their best, along with Brazil, to come up with some sort of solution to the Iranian nuclear question. They made peace with the Armenians, and they've moved to make peace with the Kurds. And so it was a policy of not fighting with your neighbors, and really being the kind of major influential force in the region. But that has sort of fallen apart, and it's fallen apart in part because the current government in Turkey, which is not a particularly radical Islamicist government, it's much more mildly Islamicist government, it's very similar to the current government in Egypt at this point, began to alienate sections of the population in Turkey. And then Erdogan, who's the prime minister, has a temper, and he decided that Syria was going to fall. He decided Assad had no support, and Syria was going to fall, and he wanted to get in on what the results were. Well, that was a misjudgment. Syria is not about to fall. Assad is not about to fall. He still has significant support in the country, and a lot of the insurgency is losing support because of the kind of radical Islamic beliefs on the part of most of the major fighters. So what happened is that Turkey sort of made a series of judgments. They were misjudgments. And then it's dug its heels in. And, you know, it's very hard to say exactly why those misjudgments were made. But they've had very serious ramifications, not only in terms of the Syrian civil war, but regionally, but even within Turkey. You've got a split now in the Islamicist party that's in power. You have a kind of a fragile economic bubble which is developing. And so you've sort of gone from big dog on the block to massive demonstrations inside Turkey and a kind of a disassembling of it all. In the case of the Israelis originally thought Assad was going to fall right away. And then they decided, no, he isn't going to fall right away. And what their role in this is that they want to see everyone weakened, basically, except with the exception of the Gulf countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council. And so to that end, they view their major enemy as Hezbollah and Iran, and they figure if Syria is either knocked off or so deeply engaged in civil war that it's no longer really a political or economic force in the Arab world, then that weakens Iran. And so its whole strategy is weaken Iran, weaken Hezbollah. They are training at this point to fight a war in southern Lebanon. Whether or not they actually do that, I don't know. That depends, I think, on developments. But that is the plan. They'd like a rematch from the 2006 invasion if they can get it. So this is a mess. I mean, Mordecai, you got to go to Shakespeare for this one. You know, cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war. And it's a mess.
Yeah, it seems that the fracturing is quite severe within, between different groupings, and no one is in control of the dynamic. So I guess that's where chaos reigns. Thank you very much for analyzing this morning some of those fractures, and we'll undoubtedly be back to explore them shortly. Thank you.
Anytime, Mordecai. It was a pleasure to be here.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Con Hallinan. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus and a contributor to many progressive publications on international politics.